Time to take a look at your pet's health now with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. Certainly, if you have a question about your pet's health or your neighbor's pet's health or just a question in general about pet health, we hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It is so nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. And on sort of a I don't know if it's a sad note, but a warning note, I guess we should talk a little bit about xylitol.
Oh, you know, that is an artificial sweetener that a lot of people like to use, and it's becoming a lot more popular. And the reason why I brought this up is I was driving down the road the other day, and I'm a big gum chewer when I'm going long distance, and pulled out this pack of gum that's just sitting kind of in a little cubby on my dashboard. My dogs are with me, and I look at the ingredients, and guess what the artificial sweetener was?
Xylitol.
There was enough xylitol in that pack of gum, one of my dogs could have probably died.
Wow.
In a pack of gum. Okay, so what this is, a sweetener, if for us, it does nothing. I mean, it tastes sweet, and, you know, it works fine. It helps, you know, control tooth decay and so on. For dogs, for whatever reason, and it seems to be only dogs, it causes a profound insulin release. So their body looks at the sugar as sugar, and the pancreas just dumps out all this insulin, which causes the dog's blood sugar to plummet, and they become severely hypoglycemic, start to seizure, and they can die. And so, you know, you've got to be careful. You can't just leave some of these things laying around like a pack of gum anymore. And there's also, you can get xylitol at, you know, various stores and things to use in baking. And so it's starting to show up more in the baked good line. And, you know, any dog that's a counter surfer, if you've, you know, making muffins or cupcakes or whatever, be careful. Keep that stuff out of reach of your dog.
Well, what about, what if they eat a muffin?
Well, it depends. I don't know. It depends on the size of the dog. We know that it's the toxic dose is 0.15 grams per kilogram. So if you've got, you know, a little Chihuahua or a Yorkie, a tiny amount, that's not very much stuff, can be quite toxic for them. So just be careful.
Be careful out there. Okay, Tom and Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Dr. Sawchuk.
Good morning.
I have a question about my cat. He hasn't been going in his litter box.
Oh.
And this has been going on now maybe about 5 to 7 days. And I've seen where he has evacuated in the corner of the basement, and then in another area he's urinated in a few spots.
Okay.
And then as far as I can tell, he hasn't done either in the last couple of days.
Uh-oh.
And I'm using a non-scented litter.
Okay.
And let's see, he seems to be okay. I mean, you know, he's not eating a whole lot, but as far as I can tell, he seems to be afraid of his litter box.
Well, I think number one thing, you've got a cat that's appetite is down. You're not seeing any signs of them eliminating. I would think that instead of calling me, you should be calling your veterinarian. This could potentially be an emergency. Sometimes cats that have either bowel obstructions or urinary tract obstructions will develop a healthy fear of the litter box because they are hurting, and they may initially start going other places, and then will start to get sick and run into troubles with decreased appetite and so on. So get them in, have the veterinarian get a urine sample, palpate the abdomen, make sure there's nothing else going on physically. If they can't find anything physically wrong, then addressing it from the behavior standpoint may be necessary. And you said litter box. I heard you say that, okay? Rule of thumb, I'll tell you, Sawchuk's rules of cat litter box management. Larry and I were just talking about this before the show, and his former cats were very atypical in that, no, whatever you gave them, they would use. But, you know, not all cats are that easy. And our rule of thumb with cats and litter boxes is a litter box for every cat in the household plus one. So if you have one cat, two litter boxes, ideally in two separate locations in your home. Just like if you were building your dream home and it had two stories, you'd have a bathroom upstairs and a bathroom downstairs to make life easy for you. The same thing works for cats. cats can be sometimes a little intimidated by big machinery like water softeners and washing machines and furnaces. So trying not to have the litter box next to any of those things makes life a little bit easier for them as well, because they're not going to be afraid to use it. Remember that keeping the litter box clean is really important. Cats use their feet to walk in there, and if it's smelly and soiled, they may decide that that bedding on your bed is nice and absorbent and soft and wonderful, and now let's just use that, because why use the dirty old litter box? And what you put in the box is important too, because sometimes cats have different litter preferences. I mean, I prefer something like Charmin versus generic toilet paper. Why can't cats have the same preference? So the soft, scoopable, unscented, sandy litter appears to be what is approved by most cats. But some cats are different and they like other things. So you have to know what your cat likes. Keep it clean every day, like I said. And then also look at the size of the litter box. Quick rule of thumb, measure your cat from its nose to its butt and go half that length again. That should be the size of the litter box, about 1.5 times the length of the cat's body from head to rear end. And, you know, we tend to buy these little commercially available litter boxes that the cat barely has room to move. And to top it off, we'll sometimes put a lid on it, which just confines the odors and makes the cat even have a smaller spot to move around in. I equate covered litter boxes to those porta potties at the state fair. Okay. Ever been in one of those? There's no way you can move around without bumping into things, and it's usually soiled and not very pleasant. So, you know, if you've got covers on the box, get those covers off. So those are just kind of a few little quick rules of thumb.
But first,
rule out medical problems. Get your kitty in to have that looked into, and hopefully they won't find anything seriously wrong.
Good luck, Tom. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Beatrice in Viroqua is next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. I have a Norwich Terrier named Bentley.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 2 years old, and he has a psychological problem. If he goes out at night, which I always take him out and bring him in, if he goes to the potty outside, then he can come in and sleep on the Afghan beside me in the bedroom.
Okay.
Okay. But now he's got a fear of the desk across the room.
Huh.
And he will lie there, and his ears are up, and he's sharp, and he's watching over there. And then he scoots all the way down to the end of the bed because he's so afraid.
Wow.
And huh. I've taken him over there and showed him everything that's on the desk.
Yeah.
And I've eliminated things. I thought something might be, like shiny or something.
Sure.
But nothing works.
Wow.
What in the world is wrong with that dog?
I have no idea. I really don't know, you know? And it can sometimes be as simple, like you're saying, seeing their reflection or, something like that. Or maybe something fell off of the desk and startled him. And now he's got this superstitious behavior that if ever I go near there, something bad may happen.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly what could have triggered something like this. Be careful that you're not feeding the dog's behavior, because sometimes the dog may just be very innocently sitting there looking at the desk, and then you go, what are you looking at? Are you okay? And now the dog's like, mom's a little worried. Maybe I should be worried. And then they look worried. Then you get more worried, and it starts this whole vicious cycle. So be careful that you're not feeding that type of behavior. Okay.
I've given up. I just go to bed and let him. Sometimes he actually slides off the end of the other side of the bed.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Okay.
He is definitely afraid of that desk.
Well, and I don't know why. You know, you can try. A couple things you could try would be, in situations where it's not nighttime, where it's, totally different context. He hasn't just been outside. He's not getting up in the bed to go to bed. Having him in the room at a distance from the desk, and having him sitting and getting treats and enjoying life, and have him gradually move over there, and then maybe you're sitting in the desk chair, tossing treats to him and having him come closer, and just realize that it's not, nothing bad's going to happen here. In fact, good things happen. You get treats when you come near the desk. And then maybe, start changing what lights are on at different times and see if, play with that a little bit, and gradually work up to, nighttime and back into your old routine again. And, hopefully you can desensitize him to what's going on there. This is where I really wish we could, have a button that we could push and find out. I have a friend who called me and said, guess what? I got a new dog. And I'm like, oh, great. This guy's got three cats already. What do you need a dog for? Turns out to be one of these little dog robots. And for him, it's the perfect pet because he can push a button on this little device and it can say what the dog's mood is. You know,
great
I'm
idea.
Itchy. I have fleas. You know, it's like, okay. You know? But yeah.
Oh, good luck, Beatrice.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. Linda and Lavalley, your turn next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a Sheltie Shepherd mix. She's a four-year-old female, and she's always had a recurring anal gland problem.
Oh, those nasty things. Yes.
Yes. And yeah. I take her on a regular basis to the vet to get her cleaned out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the problem right now. The problem is since she developed that, she started licking herself terribly and, of course, scooting on the floor.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we have not been able to break her of the habit of licking herself.
Yeah.
And it has gotten horrible. Where the vet called it an elephant kind of looking skin.
Oh, yeah. It's getting really thickened and irritating, like leather-like. Yeah.
And black.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that may have nothing to do with her anal glands. Sometimes we will see dogs that... let me just back up here a little bit. These anal glands or anal sacs are little scent glands that sit on either side of the rectum that normally empty their contents out on the surface of the dog's stool when they have a bowel movement. Cats have these as well. They just don't have as many problems as dogs seem to. And certain dogs, depending on different conditions, can have more problems than others. Some of the dogs that we see big problems with tend to be the little short-legged dogs like Basset Hounds, and some of the Shih Tzus and things, because anatomically they're just built a little bit differently. Things are tipped a little bit and they don't empty as well and they can run into troubles. We'll also see more problems in dogs with anal gland issues that are overweight. When they have a weight problem, these little glands then are kind of surrounded by fat and they get kind of slid out of the way when they have a BM, and so they don't empty normally. Those are a couple of the reasons. And then we can sometimes see dogs that have chronic loose BMs will not get the push on those glands to cause them to empty too. So if your dog is normal weight, everything's fine, then it may just be one of these anatomical variants. I used to live with Basset Hounds that had every week I was emptying them.
Oh.
And it got to the point where it, you know, was just so socially unacceptable, the odor of it. It's any of you that have ever been experienced, it's like the most vile thing on the face of the earth.
Right.
I had them surgically removed, and there's some risk involved. It's a general anesthetic procedure, but, you know, if it's in the hands of a good surgeon, they heal up fast and you never have to worry about them again. In your dog's case, though, yes, they may have had an anal gland problem, but I'd be more worried about things like, do you have a dog that's allergic? Because some dogs will start picking on certain parts of their body. There's a little saying I like to teach my vet students when it comes to food allergies. I say ears and rears. Usually the dog is, you know, scratching their ears and maybe licking their feet. Their other parts of their body are itchy, but it's usually accompanied by an itchy rectum as well. And when you see that kind of thickened skin, we start thinking about something like that as well. So I don't know if your veterinarian's looked into allergies, but that would be something to be looking into, whether it be food allergies, environmental
right.
allergies, but that needs to be evaluated. Then also look for secondary infections. When we see skin that's that thickened, sometimes we'll have yeast infections and bacterial infections on top of it, and that continues to cause the dog to itch, which makes the skin thicker, which causes more little grooves and crevices for bugs to start to develop, and it just becomes a vicious cycle. So don't keep.
Right.
Yeah,
we've changed her food quite a few times. She's been on different antibiotics. We recently tried Clomicalm.
Okay. Yeah.
Thinking it was psychological that she was continuously doing this pattern, this behavior, and also going at her, like you said, the paws. She bites her pads.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be so concerned about allergies, but you know what? Your little comment about changing foods, remember, it's not the food. It's the ingredients in the food. It's usually either the protein or the carbohydrate source. So changing from one brand to another usually doesn't do anything because most of the foods are going to have beef or chicken or soya or corn or whatever else is in it. So when we're really wanting to go through a diet trial to see if it is a food allergy, we're usually going with one of these prescription diets The one that I like to use is called ZD. It's by Hill's. It's a hydrolyzed protein diet. Nestle Purina has one out called HA as well. And either of those would be ones to consider using for about 8 to 12 weeks. That's all they get. They don't even get their flavored heartworm pill. You have to get their heartworm medication into them a different way rather than using those flavored pills. So they get no treats. They get that in water, and we see how they do on that. I'd also be recommending that your veterinarian consider doing some allergy testing for environmental allergens. And there's some what's called e-screen, which is a little blood test that you can send off. That's a nice, you know, easy way to just assessing, you know, what's going on with the environment, and then maybe following up with skin testing if that's something your veterinarian does, or going to a veterinary dermatologist to follow up on that.
Things to do. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Have a question? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, 263-1890. And let's go on to Bill in Madison next. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. I have a question for you about a heretofore very healthy 15-year-old cat who has since become losing weight, has begun to lose weight. The appetite has not been diminished with regard to the soft food that we've been serving her, which is just a tablespoonful in the evening. Her dry food, however, has not been touched much. And I'm wondering if this might be indicative of some dental issues or...
Yeah. You know, anytime we have a senior citizen cat that, or any a pet, you know, where we're not attempting to get them to lose weight, which most pets do need to lose weight, but as they get older, especially a 15-year-old cat that is has an appetite change and is losing weight, you need to be thinking about some pretty serious medical problems. And yes, dental disease can cause them to not want to eat their crunchy food. It takes typically some pretty significant dental problems to get a cat to not want to chew their food, and because if you've ever watched a cat eat solid food, they sometimes just swallow it whole. In fact, I've cleaned it up after it's gone down and back up again, and it's like been barely crunched on for the most part. That's the way cats normally eat. They're carnivores. They're used to swallowing chunks of food. So with the kitty's appetite being off and losing weight, you know, still eating some canned food, getting your kitty in for a good physical exam, that'd be number one. The vet can open the mouth up, have a look, see what the teeth look like, evaluate for anything else in the oral cavity that could be a problem. Cats with significant oral disease will usually drool, chew on one side over the other, have odor from their mouth, maybe some bleeding. I doubt that you're seeing anything like that because that would probably have had you at the vet right away.
Yeah,
the other things that I would be thinking about, two common age-related problems in 15-year-old cats. Number one is hyperthyroidism, an overactive thyroid gland. Cats will get benign thyroid nodules, very common as cats get older, that secrete thyroid hormone that puts the metabolism into overdrive. And some cats will be feeling really great with this, and they're back to be playing and doing well. And as time goes on, they become thyroid toxic. It affects their heart. They lose so much muscle mass. They become weak, and they can die from it. The other problem that we'll run into troubles with in older cats is kidney disease. And that can throw their appetite off. They may still be drinking and doing okay that way, but their appetite, just because they're kind of nauseated with the kidney toxin levels building up, they may not be eating as well. So some simple things to do: get your cat into your vet clinic with a full bladder. This is always, for us, so frustrating because, you know, for humans, you can send patient down the hall with a little cup saying, give us a sample. For pets, we need to get it directly from the bladder. So if you can, put your cat in the carrier, 2-3 hours before going to the vet clinic. That way, we're ensured that we have a full bladder when they come in, hopefully. And good physical exam, including blood pressure, and then be, you know, expecting to, you know, have a little lab work done too, urinalysis and some blood work.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thanks, Bill, for calling. Appreciate it. Dawn in Madison, you are up. Hi, Dawn.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is we have an 11-year-old, almost 12-year-old male Samoyed who is also a diabetic, and he was just diagnosed with a cruciate tear. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering what his best options are for treatment, especially given his age as well as he's, you know, he is diabetic.
Yeah. Well, first of all, age isn't a disease. Okay. So remember that. I have seen some very spry 11-year-old large breed dogs and others that are very aged at that point. An anterior cruciate rupture is one of these ligaments that stabilizes the knee. And when one of these ligaments ruptures, the anterior cruciate is the most common one that we run into troubles with, it causes the knee to be unstable. So every time the dog bears weight on it, the joint kind of slides, the bones slide on each other and can cause the meniscus to get folded or torn. It's painful. And eventually they will develop very serious arthritis in the knee, lose a lot of muscle mass in the leg as well if they're not using it. And, you know, the longer you wait, sometimes the harder it is to be able to do corrective surgery to be able to get it under control. So, you know, putting aside the fact that your dog is a diabetic, an 11-year-old dog that is in good health otherwise could go on to live, two, three, maybe, if you're lucky, four more years. I don't know. It just depends on genetics. And you can go back and look at how long his mom and dad lived and his litter mates and so on to get some idea of how long he may live. But, you know, and that's a pretty good significant amount of time for a dog. I mean, that's you know, if someone were to tell you, well, you know, if we did this to you, you could live another, you know, 10 to 15% more or 20% more. I think we'd jump on that. And that would be what you might be looking at for your dog just for its comfort. It's not inexpensive surgery, no matter what surgery's done. It's a general anesthetic procedure. There's going to be lots of post-operative physical therapy and care on your part. And there's a couple of different surgical techniques that are popularly used out there now. One that's like a lateral suture that puts a stabilizing suture on the outside of the joint to try to keep it stable. There's another technique called TPLO that's becoming a lot more popular in large breed dogs. They tend to get up and get moving a lot faster after that particular surgery, but it's a lot more complicated and a little more expensive to do. So that would be something your veterinarian can talk to you about, pros and cons. My own dog ruptured his cruciate, and that's why I have pet insurance now, because I think it cost me, it was about $3,000 to have it done. Yeah. You know, and so that can be a chunk of change, but it also, he's a functional dog now and quite happy. Now, the fact that your dog is a diabetic, that means that it's going to take a little bit longer to heal. They're not going to be healing quite as quickly. They may be more prone to post-operative infections. And so this would be something where maybe covering the dog with antibiotics, being a little bit more careful about how long you leave sutures in to make sure that everything's healed up properly is going to be more critical. But if they're well-regulated diabetic, that shouldn't pose too much of a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. The number for you to join in, 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Dave in Spring Green next. Hi, Dave.
Steve, actually. But,
oh, Steve, okay.
Last night when I walked my golden retriever, he's 12 and a half years old, good shape. He was a little slow at walking, but I thought, oh, well.
Mm-hmm.
10 o'clock last night, he was sleeping, and all of a sudden, he just started shaking all over, and his legs went straight out. And I got him outside, and he couldn't walk at that point. And finally, he came around, and he could walk, and then he started, like, favoring his left. He started going to his left all the time.
Spin, like then, turning, circling to the left?
Yes.
Okay.
And that lasted for maybe a minute, maybe. And then he's okay. This morning he seems okay. And I was wondering, do dogs have strokes or...
Well, it sounds like with the legs going straight and the shaking all over that your dog had a seizure. And the fact that he was circling to the left afterwards may be what we call the post-ictal or after-seizure effects. And if we do see vascular accidents, strokes in animals, they don't recover, just like people. I mean, they do recover. They can sometimes, but you're not going to see them be back to normal the next day. And your dog would still have some residual nerve deficits and probably mentation changes, just like a person that had a stroke. They don't get better, you know, just by having a good night's sleep. Takes a lot of physical therapy and, you know, time and so on before they are able to improve to the best function. So for whatever reason, your dog had a seizure. And to for an 11 and a half year old dog to have this as the first time in their life have a seizure, it kind of rules out things like just general epilepsy, which is, you know, we see in younger dogs where they inherit some, you know, minor brain defect that causes them to start seizuring. Dog like this, I'd be worried about things like a small brain tumor that may not be causing them any outward signs, but could be a source of irritation to the brain. It could be something as simple as low blood sugar. We had a dog in the other day at the clinic that was an older dog that had a tumor in its pancreas called an insulinoma, secreted insulin all the time, and that lowered the blood sugar, and the dog was having hypoglycemic attacks that looked like seizures. So it comes down to 12-and-a-half-year-old dog, get them in for a physical exam. If you haven't had any geriatric lab work done recently, good idea to get chemistry, a blood cell count, and a urinalysis done. And, you know, and then part of the physical exam will be to have your veterinarian do a good neurologic exam as well, where they check the reflexes, they look at, you know, subtle changes in if the dog knows where its feet are in space, check pupil size, look at the back of the eyes or the retina. You know, so your veterinarian will spend a lot of time putting your dog through the paces to see if they can localize where a problem may be. For many dogs, you don't see that. You can't find where it's localized. So if you want to take it a step further, then a referral to a clinic like where I work, where we have neurologists on staff, and the next step would probably be getting magnetic resonance imaging done, an MRI, which is done under general anesthetic, unlike it is in people. We can't get a dog to just lay in that tube very long, you know, perfectly still. And, you know, maybe a spinal fluid tap as well, maybe in order to see what's going on.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much for calling.
Not the news he wanted to hear.
No, I'm sure.
I know.
I'm sure it was.
Those
not.
Are always troubling cases when we get them in. Yeah.
Cindy and Marinette is up next. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two cockapoos. One is a female. She's 26 pounds. The other one is a male. He's 6 pounds. The female spayed. We never did anything with the male dog. We live in the country, so we didn't. Think we thought if we fixed one it would be okay, but every time I have two problems with the little male dog. Every time the female dog gets groomed, he acts like she's in heat.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And the other thing that he does is that he's still piddling in the house, even though he knows how to go outside. They're in and out all the time at will because we live in the country. So could you help me with those two issues?
Yeah, when he's urinating in the house, is he lifting his leg on things?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. How did I know? Hey, you know, we just did this. We had a nice little discussion in rounds with my students yesterday about, you know, telling people, you know, why should we spay and neuter? Besides just birth control, there are a lot of other reasons. And for male dogs in particular, there are a lot of behavioral problems that we see that are driven by that hormone testosterone. And the big things that we see are, you know, them showing more interest in other dogs. And my guess is that when your little female goes to get groomed, is she comes back probably smelling like other dogs because she's been at a grooming parlor, not smelling like herself because she's been all foo-fooed up with perfume and whatever, shampoos and stuff that they use. And so she's a new dog. And he is, you know, very attracted to the fact that I have a new dog in the house right now. And, you know, maybe she's not spayed and maybe I can have a girlfriend. So, you know, that's probably what's driving that is just his strong sex drive being an intact male. Other things that we'll see is urine marking. And not all dogs that are neutered will stop urine marking because it's done for two reasons. One, sexually, to mark their territory, to leave little calling cards for potential girlfriends, okay? And to mark their territory for other male dogs to say, hey, I live here. You know, this is my turf. You stay away. Even though he may be, again, a little foo-foo dog, doesn't make any difference. In his mind, he's like the only male there in the household. But some dogs, even after they're neutered, it's about 50-50, can, if they're feeling socially anxious, even if they're neutered, may continue to urine mark. So number one thing you would do is get him castrated, okay? Get him neutered. And then, you know, that will maybe solve all of your problems. If they don't, then we start looking at the social interaction between you and the dog and the two dogs together and try to figure out if we can make life a little bit easier for you. But that is one of the more difficult behavior problems in neutered male dogs to get under control. And remember, there's also health benefits to neutering a male dog. We know that by about 7 years of age, almost 100% of male dogs will have what's called benign prostatic hyperplasia, increased prostate size that can lead to prostatic cysts and prostatic abscesses, prostatitis, and it can be, you know, pretty serious health risks for him. So getting him neutered is going to eliminate that, will eliminate the risk of testicular cancer, perineal hernias around the rectum, as well as little masses that can occur around the rectum as well called perianal tumors. So I think your dog's going to be happier and mentally happier if you kind of eliminate that sex drive a little bit.
Okay.
Thanks,
Amy.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling.
An inexpensive fix, you know?
Yeah, that's not an expensive fix.
You know, when you look at it, it is a general anesthetic surgery, but most veterinarians, even at the vet school, we undercharge for these routine surgeries because we look at how socially important they are and we want to have this done. And so my guess is, depending on the location that you live in, you're probably going to be looking at $100 to $200. Maybe another vet can call in and give me some idea of in other cities. But I think here we charge about $150 for a male at the vet school. So,
all right. There you have it. Good luck, Cindy. Rod in, and should I say good luck to your pooch, too?
Yes. Yeah.
And on to Rod in Berlin. Hi, Rod.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, we've got a 2-year-old mini doxy. And, you know, I don't know how to say this politely, but you know, she'll eat poop if we don't watch her closely.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of dogs love to do that.
Yeah, and you know, it is such a common problem. It came up in one of the exam rooms yesterday, and I can tell you what I told the owner. I said the top three things that you need to do for a dog that is a stool eater is pick it up. Okay. Sorry. Those are the top three things. And then the other things are after that. But you do need to be out there. And when dogs have this type of problem, it's usually dogs that have a fenced-in backyard. They go out unattended. The owner's sitting in the kitchen drinking a cup of coffee. They look through the window. They get disgusted. They yell at the dog. The dog gets attention, and they just continue on doing this. Why some dogs do it and others don't, it may be how they were raised as puppies. If they were like a pet store dog in a cage, they didn't have enough toys, and this became something, you know, an unenriched environment, the only thing that they could play with. It's rarely ever due to medical circumstances. Okay, so get your dog checked out. Make sure that they're healthy and happy, that they don't have any digestive disorders or anything like that, that you've got them on the best possible diet that you can afford so that it's highly digestible. You're not getting a lot of waste material passing out in the stool. But for the most part, these dogs are normal stool, good diets, no other problem. It's just become a habit for them. So if you're picking it up all the time, then there's no way they can eat it. But I'll agree. I mean, it's hard sometimes to be there all the time. So,
especially in the wintertime, yeah.
Yeah, poopsicles, we call those, you know? Yeah, changes the mouthfeel. So a couple things you can try. There's some over-the-counter products that make the stool taste bad. One's called Forbid. The other one that I know of is called Deter. Their little logo is the number one product for dogs that eat number two. It makes the stool taste bad. You mix it in their food. Downside of that, if this is a 2-year-old dog, if this has been a longstanding problem, you can use it till the bottle runs out and the dog may not eat stool. And then a few days later, they'll start doing it again. And the analogy that I use is you eat apples all your life. You love apples. You go to the store, you buy one, you bite into it. It's horrible. It's mealy. It's yucky. Do you give up on apples the rest of your life? Or do you just say, you know what? Bad season for apples. I'll try again later. That's what happens with these dogs that have been used to eating stool and not having a problem. There's another product on the market that seems to work quite well, too, that you can use chronically called Prozyme. They even sell it at the grocery store that I go to, but you can get it online. Your veterinarian may carry it. Readily available. It's a powder that you mix with food, and it's an enzyme product. Again, some dogs do better with that too. But, you know, give the dog other things to do out in the backyard, toys, balls, and so on. And that may help too.
Good
so,
luck.
Yep.
Thank you very much for calling, Rod.
Brush the dog's teeth before you let them kiss you. Yeah.
Yes. John and Baronette, your turn now. Hi, John.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Well, I don't have a medical question for you, but I do have a question regarding breeds.
Okay.
I recently had a Jack Russell Terrier that I loved with all my heart and had him for many years, and he finally got old and is no longer with us.
Uh-huh.
That's been about 10 months, and I'm starting to think about another dog.
Okay.
Feeding and looking at standard Schnauzers.
Uh-huh.
Although they're hard to find.
Yeah.
And I liked the attitude of my Jack and everything about him other than the fact that he shed like...
Right.
It was unbelievable that he wasn't bald as an egg.
Okay. Yeah, they do tend to produce, you know, a lot of hair. Yeah, and it gets replaced again. Uh-huh.
Wife would never go for another Jack Russell just because of the hair.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice not having
so a you're looking at giant Schnauzers as a...
Standard, not...
Or standard Schnauzer. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And wondering if the temperament is kind of similar, maybe not quite as much attitude, I don't think.
Well, I think anytime you're going to be looking at a dog, you know, you're doing the right thing. You're doing your homework. Go to a dog show, look at these dogs, you know, talk to breeders about them, you know, watch how they interact with other dogs at, you know, in a situation like that. Visit with mom and dad. Don't even look at the puppies. You know, spend time, if you can, see mom and dad and see what their temperament's like, because so much of that is inherited. That and you want a dog that's going to be, you know, pretty easygoing. You know, obviously, this is going to be a dog that probably needs to go to the groomer more often, so you'll have to factor that into your budget, taking them to the groomer to have their hair cut. So instead of buying vacuum cleaner bags, you're going to be spending time taking the dog to the groomer and dropping whatever, 30, 40, 50, 60 bucks every 6 to 8 weeks. I don't know. It depends on where you live and what you want your dog to look like. So that's going to be, you know, something to be considering. But, you know, choosing a dog breed for someone, again, this came up in the exam room yesterday. Mm-hmm. Somebody said, well, what kind of dog should I get? And I said, you know, that's like me choosing your spouse.
Yeah.
I can't do that. And, you know, I think Schnauzers are, I mean, miniature Schnauzers tend to be a little barky. They're, you know, very playful, you know, kind of the high-octane dogs. The standard and the giant tend to be a little more mellow, and not as barky. And you know, so if that's, I think they're great dogs, but it's all going to depend on where you get it from and who the parents are.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. I have a question on xylitol coming up, Sandy. But before we get to that, you mentioned that you have pet insurance.
I do. You know, and it's people always look at me like, you're a veterinarian and you have pet insurance. But I'm kind of in a special situation in that I do not do surgery in my current position at the vet school. And so it's been 20 years since I picked up a scalpel blade. I hate to even admit it, but I mean, I probably could get back into it if I needed to. But things become so specialized that, you know, my dog, when he ruptured his anterior cruciate, I was like, oh, gee, you know, I don't want to have to go through that. So I have insurance on both my pets, just covering emergency stuff like that, because, you know, I don't want to be in a situation where I have to be the veterinarian for my own pets. And it's worth it for me to do that. But I get reports from my pet insurance company, and they one little funny statistic that came out. Guess what the number one foreign body was that they pull out of, when they keep stats on this, of course, and everybody makes a claim, that they take out of the intestinal tract of dogs. Number one foreign body.
Small ball?
Nope. Men's socks. So the question is, what is it about men's socks? Is it the size, the taste, or the fact that they're left on the floor all the time? So I think it's probably the last thing. So you guys out there, keep your socks off the floor. We don't want to see you guys be this, one of the statistics for these dogs, you know? Yes, men's socks, number one foreign body in dogs.
Oh, man.
Yes.
Well,
I was just trying to remember if my socks were left on the floor.
Well, I won't let my dogs come over and visit. There you go.
Debbie in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I don't know how many in your listening audience are like I am, a petless person, but loves to listen to your show.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
And just like now you've just answered the question, you know, where did the socks go? Not the
yeah. Maybe that is the mystery, you know? Yeah. Start looking out in the backyard. Yeah.
But I did have a comment about your xylitol comment mm-hmm. at the top of the show. Xylitol is not an artificial sweetener.
It's a, well, I don't know if you want to call it an artificial sweetener. It's a wood sugar, yes.
Well, it's often called a sugar substitute, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but it's a naturally occurring 5-carbon sugar alcohol.
Okay, yes.
And the sources, the commercial sources are from birch trees, for example, or corn cobs or stalks.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
it is not an artificial sweetener. Oh. It is beneficial yeah. uh-huh. for humans, but unfortunately it was great to hear about dogs.
Yes,
so
yes.
That's very important.
And I'm sorry I got my terminology wrong.
But that's very important to distinguish between
yeah. Yeah.
The uses. It is not artificial.
Okay, well, here's what I have written down, and I should have actually, instead of saying what I did, it's a, like you said, a 5-carbon sugar, okay, and that it is found in the fibers of many fruits and vegetables, and it can be extracted from corn fiber, birch, raspberries, plums, and mushrooms. It is a safe sweetener for diabetic humans and does not impact their insulin level. So
there are many health benefits,
yeah.
but it's not artificially derived.
Yes,
and I
right.
think that's an important distinction to
okay.
make.
All
thanks,
right.
Deb.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
You're welcome and really pleased to have you call
I
in.
I know.
Thanks.
Well, you know, hey, I'm...
Let's get the terms
I'm
right.
I'm a veterinarian. I'm not a chemist. Sorry. No.
Let's go to Joan in Menominee next. Hi, Joan.
Oh, hi. Listen, I've got a little, I think, about a 7-year-old Papillon who... was a breeder dog in a puppy mill for the first 6 years of her life.
Ooh, okay.
And she came to live with me about a year ago. And maybe 3 or 4 months ago, I noticed she was drinking quite a bit, so I took her to the vet. I thought she had a UTI probably, but she came up negative for that. But as a result of a blood test, we found she had a high lymphocyte count.
Mm-hmm.
She's showing no symptoms at all. She's a healthy, happy dog.
Okay.
The only reason I took her in was because she was drinking a lot. Anyway, so I took her to the University of Minnesota, and they did a urine culture,
mm-hmm.
which also came up negative. And now people are starting to talk about possibilities like leukemia
mm-hmm.
Or an inflammation of some kind.
Okay.
And so I guess my question for you is if you can think as, you know, with a history of being in a puppy mill, if there is anything that a person would be looking for as a result of that, some
no.
kind of inflammation that is common?
No. Just 7-year-old female dog in general, some of the things that I'd be worried about would be, as diabetes could be, but they've ruled that out, no sugar
right.
in the urine.
Right.
Cushing's disease, which is overactive adrenal glands, and there's typically different lab results that you get back on that help push you looking into that as a diagnosis. Kidney disease, kidney failure, not concentrating their urine because their mm-hmm. kidneys aren't working up to snuff. And I assume that that's all been looked into, that
right.
she's well concentrated.
Yeah.
Then we start thinking about if you've ruled out all the medical reasons, then is there a psychological problem that is causing her to drink more? And the fact that she spent 6 years in a cage as a breeding animal, many of them do develop some weird compulsive disorders, pacing, circling, you know, sometimes they'll, be licking things, drinking more water even, you know. So if she's able to concentrate her urine and her lab work is relatively normal, the lymphocytes, unless they're atypical lymphocytes or she's got bone marrow abnormalities on bone marrow check or lymph nodes that are abnormal, you know, dogs that have leukemia or lymphoma or any of those typically don't drink more unless there's something wrong with their, like, calcium level, which can sometimes go along with that cancer. Some of these cancers will cause dogs to produce a pseudo hormone that causes the calcium levels to go up, and that may make them go into kidney failure, and they drink more and so on. But you know, you're in good hands at University of Minnesota, and that they are like the urinary tract wonders of the world there. And if they can't figure it out, I doubt that a simple little veterinarian like me with a telephone call and with no records in front of me is going to be able to figure it out. But one thing that you can do at home, and this is always helpful for us as veterinarians, is quantify how much water she's actually taking in, because she may not actually be drinking that much. You may think she is, but if you fill the water bowl up with a measuring cup and every 24 hours figure out how much water she's drinking over a 24-hour period of time and take an average, then the vets that are working with her may have some idea of how truly, you know, polydipsic or over-consuming of water she is.
Okay, can I ask one more question?
Sure.
If indeed she has leukemia, as people are wondering because of the lymphocyte count, what can I expect? I mean, she seems absolutely fine now.
Yeah.
And she's a happy, healthy, good appetite, lots of energy, chases squirrels, you know.
Well, I wouldn't be expecting, if she has clinical leukemia with her blood cell counts being out of whack, she shouldn't be feeling good. Usually they are, you know, starting to, you know, get run down and having problems. And if, you know, she does have that, it's horrible. I mean, it's not a nice kind of cancer to have at all. And you'd be then, instead of working with the renal specialists or the internists, they'd be probably shifting you over to oncology. And the protocols that the oncologists have now for dealing with various kinds of cancer are right up there with what they have for people. All kinds of research protocols, proven protocols, and, you know, we can give dogs very good quality of life. And that's the difference between humans, treating humans with cancer and pets with cancer, is although we want to, you know, try to extend their life as long as we can, we want to keep them comfortable. We don't want the side effects of the medication to outweigh the benefits. We're not trying to cure them. We're trying to give them better quality of life longer so that you can enjoy them and they can enjoy life longer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the nice thing about, you know, working with cancer with pets is we're very aware of that they may not live as long as their healthy counterparts, but they're going to be happy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Thanks, great. Joan.
Thank you.
And Tara in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Tara.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
Great.
Great. I have a quick question. I have a 4-year-old Brittany Spaniel. Recently got him from the local Humane Society. Otherwise, great dog when we're with him. Unfortunately, when we leave the house, the little bugger causes a lot of problems as far as getting into things and you know, going to the bathroom all over the house.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Then we've tried several different things with him. We've, you know, we've put him in a cage over, you know, during the day, come home during the day. We've, you know, just the numerous things. And still he finds a way to either get out of all sorts of cages, the metal cages that you can find at the store, the plastic cages he's chewed out of.
Oh, boy.
You know, just a lot of anxiety, it seems, that when we're gone from the house.
Welcome to the world of, you know, this is such a common behavior problem in dogs that are rescues. I believe your dog probably has separation anxiety. I'm not sure. Okay.
Yeah.
I think you really need to work with somebody that can take a good behavioral history.
Okay.
But it's not uncommon for dogs that have been in a rough life, a situation. Suddenly they have a family that loves them, and they can be perfect angels when you're there. But when you walk out the door, they think you're gone for good. They have no idea that you're coming back, and they're abandoned. And, you know, and so by putting them in a crate, you've just put the anxiety in a box. And by leaving them alone in the house, they panic and they'll urinate, defecate, bark, chew, dig, try to escape. I've had dogs jump through windows to try to get back to the owner again. I had one dog that actually made it up onto the roof of the house by, you know, climbing up on things and was up on the roof, panting and all distressed. So this is something that you need to work with your veterinarian. And if your veterinarian's well-versed in behavior, they may be able to help you completely. If not, you may also need to be working with a behaviorist, not a trainer, but someone that deals with dog behavior, because okay. you have to realize that if you come home and punish this dog, you're just going to aggravate things.
Correct.
And, you know, there's medication that we can use to help speed the training process up, but there's okay. a very, you know, good program out there for teaching dogs to be comfortable and relaxed while you leave them alone. And it's pretty standard. You can read about it. Dr. McConnell has a book out, Patricia McConnell. I think it's called I'll Be Home Soon. You may want to read that one. Go online, look up some stuff on separation anxiety. But it's not usually something that you're going to be able to solve on your own. You're going to probably need the help of medical management and the assistance of an animal behaviorist as well.
Okay, great. Thank you for answering my question.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's see. Do we have time? Yeah, let's go to Dee Dee in Round Lake. Hi, Dee Dee.
Hi. I have a question. We were talking about spaying a little while ago,
mm-hmm.
and I devastatingly lost my 9-year-old Keyshound in a surgery last November,
mm-hmm.
and it happened to be within a couple of weeks of her rabies booster. I've since adopted a rescue, and she needs to be spayed, and I've read that there could be some danger of doing a surgery within a month of having a
vaccines. Yeah, yeah. You know, there may be absolutely no problems, but I always recommend that you separate out medical procedures. Spaying is a major medical procedure. Mucking with their immune system, which is necessary, giving them vaccines, is a major medical procedure, even though we do it every day. And very, very uncommon side effects of vaccines can involve sometimes changes in blood cell counts. It can be rarely causing things called thrombocytopenia, low platelet count level, which could complicate surgery. Before surgery's done, even if the dog was vaccinated 1 month, 2 months, if your veterinarian offers you pre-treatment lab work, get it done. It's really important, and that'll help keep your dog healthy and happy.
And thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at your pet's health now with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. Lots of callers online. Before we go to the phones, though, Sandy, the question of fleas hasn't come up today. I thought it might, but it hasn't yet. And you've got you were doing some looking and found some information on vacuuming.
Vacuuming, you know, and you know, fleas are something that I don't see a whole lot of anymore. Now there's so many great flea products on the market. In fact, some new ones that are out there now too. So be prepared when people go in for their spring checkup to have the veterinarian talk to you about some of the newer flea products that are on the market. But if you're one of those unfortunate families, maybe didn't, you know, put a flea preventative on your dog or flea treatment or your cat and you got fleas in your house, just vacuuming alone is just found to be one of the most effective ways of controlling some of the stuff in the environment without using insecticides. And this study looked at putting just fleas in a vacuum cleaner bag, and they survived. It has something to do with the brushes and hurting their kind of waxy coat on the outside, mm-hmm. and they get sucked up. But you can control a lot of the problem with just vacuuming. And when we say vacuuming, we don't mean just, you know, your regular carpet, but under the cushions of your couch, under the couch, baseboards, hardwood floors, tile floors, because we can have fleas in all those little areas, little nooks and crannies. So we want to get all those life stages and use that vacuum.
All right. And that'll do a lot of good.
It does a lot of good. Yeah.
Mary in La Crosse has a question or two for you. So let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have two questions. And Sandy, one of them, if you know the answer to it, could make you a millionaire.
All right. I've got my fingers crossed. Yeah.
I have a wonderful kitty. There are no buts. And he was a rescue, and my daughter says he's a Maine Coon kitty. But I noticed that on his hairs, when he sheds, and which he does, that the colors change. Mm-hmm. And I thought, now what controls that? And if you could figure out how to just keep that color darker, then we little old ladies and little old men wouldn't turn into gray-haired people.
Oh.
So I was wondering, that's question number one. And the question number two is, my kitty was a rescue, and most of the time he hides except for me,
mm-hmm.
which is perfectly fine. He's an adorable cat, probably 9, 10 years old.
Okay.
But I have a friend I moved into an apartment 2.5 years ago, and when she came over, he came out. She has serious health problems, and he nuzzled her, and every time she comes, he comes out. Then lo and behold, I have another young college neighbor who has come down with some unusual health problems, and when she comes over, he comes out, he climbs on her lap, which she doesn't do for...
He's a therapy cat.
Yes, and I've heard that, you know, of dogs that can detect illness, but I've never heard it for cats, and wondered what your insight is.
Well, let's go back, first of all, to the hair issue. If you're talking about the fact that the hair shaft itself is multi-toned, that's normal genetics for cats, okay? And it has nothing to do with aging. It's just if you look at cats' hair... as it's growing, that's the there may be pigment in the tip and not at the base. It can be sometimes the hair itself may be a little appears striped, and that's just normal cat hair coat genetics. And we're not cats; it's not an age related thing, you know. So I'm not going to make $1 million. Oh well, okay. Regarding the friends that are coming over that are ill, a couple things come to mind. You know, cats. Having someone actually, you know, go up to them, you know, say, oh, here, kitty, kitty, that will turn off a lot of shy cats. But if someone comes in who is, you know, maybe ill, unable to get up and move, and is just sitting in one place, ignoring the cat, they're more inclined to come over and investigate because that's how cats interact with each other. They kind of turn their back and they play hard to get. And that's what we always recommend is just ignore the cat and the cat will usually come to you. So it may not have anything to do with illness. It may just be the fact that your friends may not be as physically able to interact with the cat, which the cat interprets as, oh, these people are safer to be around. And so they come out and, you know, he comes out and sits on their lap. I don't know if he's like a disease detector, but, you know, and but if he is, you know, maybe that's where that's you great. Can make your $1 million, yeah. You know, hire him out. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Mary. Thanks a lot for calling. All right. Ben in Fremont. We'll go to you now. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I may have a simple question here, but I have a German short hair, that dog that has a bobtail, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And it bleeds a lot.
The tip of the tail?
Yeah, the tip of the tail. And he's 3 years old, so it's not like he just got bobbed a couple weeks ago or anything.
Okay. Does he chew at it?
Not in our... He doesn't pay it any attention when he's in our presence.
Okay,
you know? So I don't think he does.
Okay. Have you ever attempted to... I mean, have you taken him to the veterinarian to see if there's any lumps, bumps, sores, anything that is... not a function of, you know, the end of the tail where it's been docked being a problem for him? I mean, what have you done so far? Anything?
What I have done is put new skin on it.
Okay.
as a recommendation from someone.
It's
right on the, I mean, you know, right on the
edge.
I don't know, bony tip. You know, I mean, it's right on the end.
That he may have to have it redocked. Sometimes when we're doing these tail docks, we do them, you know, veterinarians do it breeders when the puppies are 2 or 3 days of age. Mm-hmm. And if a fragment of bone, like when they made the incision, instead of cutting between the vertebra of the tail, they left a piece of bone in there, it could be causing some healing issues and allowing it to break open. Or if they didn't suture the tail when he was 2 or 3 days of age, and you've got a lot of scar tissue over it and very thin tissue, just like sitting on the ground or hitting it against something could cause it to break open. And so removing that hairless scar tissue, going in, maybe even taking an x-ray to see what kind of bony structure is left in there, and maybe shortening it just a bit may allow it to heal better and get some, you know, proper sutures in there. That would be my suggestion, is get an x-ray of it and, you know, maybe consider, you know, redocking just for, you know, your dog's comfort. It's going to get infected. It's messy. It's all over your house. So, yeah, I think it'd be a good idea to get him back to the vet and have that looked into.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Tom in Stoddard, your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon, Larry, and good afternoon, Sandy.
Hi.
I wanted to add one thing at the end of my comment about a cat falling into a bucket, if I could, about add something about fleas. But anyway,
okay.
a couple of years ago, we had a kitten that fell into a big bucket of oil, and we tried detergents, we tried soaps, we just tried everything, and nothing was even beginning to cut it. And all of a sudden, my ex-wife thought of cornmeal.
Okay.
And we rubbed that into the fur, and it was just amazing.
It sucked up the extra oil. Yeah.
And then we did some detergent, and fine.
Okay.
Oh, wonderful.
But be very careful because, you know, cats, their skin can absorb certain chemicals and things. And so if you're using really harsh detergents, that can be a problem for some cats. So be careful. I know that, you know, using things like a little bit of, like, you know, dish soap and so on may, but, you know, rinse well, be careful, and check with your vet before you just start pulling out any detergent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you had another comment, too.
When a person would happen to get a lot of fleas in the house, I think that they could really help themselves a lot by taking a lot of the clothing and putting them in plastic bags and tie them shut, and they wouldn't have to worry about them coming down. Because if they're enclosed without air for 6 weeks, I believe, then they would be no problem from there on.
Oh, I have to disagree with you because, you know, fleas, the fleas that we see on our cats and dogs, it's typically what's called the cat flea. It spends its life on the dog or the cat. It lays eggs. The eggs hatch into larvae. Larvae form into a cocoon. They usually are hatching in places like this, the pet's bedding, you know, between the cushions of your sofa or so on, where the eggs are falling off. You're not going to typically find them on stuck in clothing unless the pet is making a nest out of clothing. And those fleas that are in the cocoon stage can survive in that cocoon stage, in environments, you know, they don't do well below freezing or in wet, really damp, wet areas because they'll drown. But they can survive for months in that cocoon stage before they're ready and the right environment comes around for where they can hatch. Washing the clothing in hot water would probably be better. But I don't, you know, again, if it's clothing that a human is wearing, I don't know how fleas would be on that. Mm-hmm. I think you're looking in the wrong spots in the house with clothing. And I know that they recommend that for lice, although lice typically don't live very long off of the host as well. And remember, lice that pets get are very different than lice that what people get. Lice are very host specific. So if you have a cat or a dog with their own lice, it's not transmissible to people, or vice versa. Human lice is not transmissible to dogs.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you for calling. Elizabeth in Boscobel, it's your turn. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Larry and Sandy.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
About 6 years ago, my mother and I purchased a year-old Great Pyrenees male intact to have for guarding and for breeding possibly in the future.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, we had our first litter of puppies.
Good for you.
Three, and they were all perfect and wonderful. But this past January, or last January, in 2007, we had a litter of nine.
Mm-hmm.
Big surprise for us. But three out of the nine had undershot jaws.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, so, and the thing about this male was that when we purchased him, he had not been socialized to humans, so we hadn't really been able to get our hands on him. And he was eating fine. We were having no problems. So this last January here, I managed to get my hands on him. And I found out he has an undershot jaw.
He should not be used for breeding.
That's what I was saying. But my mother and I were having a discussion about it. She's like, oh, no, it doesn't matter.
Well, so, I have to disagree.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
that's what I needed to know.
When you are owning a reproducing animal like this, you are going to be responsible for, when someone asks me, what kind of guarantee do you want to look for with a breeder? Pat answer is lifetime, okay? Lifetime guarantee. So what that encourages breeders to do then is making sure that their pet is not only mentally stable, physically the best you can possibly be, meeting if it's a purebred animal, breed standards and so on. And they also want to make sure that those puppies are going to be placed in appropriate homes, trained appropriately, so that they don't come back being social deviants because they haven't been raised appropriately. And in this situation, you've got, a birth defect, having a short lower jaw that for a dog that's going to be used for guarding that may need his mouth, may not be able to function properly. And yes, your dog can eat, but is he able to do a job correctly? And, you know, you are just now perpetuating a known birth defect in the line. What I'd be recommending is all his offspring should be spayed or neutered, and he needs to be neutered as well.
Well, you just solved an argument for me. Thank you.
There you go.
All right.
You are being responsible. Thank you for being responsible. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Elizabeth. Appreciate it. Debbie in Galesville, on to you now. Hi, Deb.
Hi, good morning, or good afternoon, Larry and Sandy.
Hi.
I'm calling earlier. You had a call about a lady with the rabies and surgeries.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I have a Boston Pug cross, and he's 3 years old, and I want to get him neutered. And I'm worried, my other pug, they gave her shot right before her surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And is it dangerous, or how long should I
wait? It is, for the great majority of pets, it is not a problem. If in an ideal world, I would be separating out those medical procedures. I'd say vaccinate, let their immune system respond, produce good levels of immunity rather than stressing them and then, you know, doing a surgery right away. You're going to get better response to the vaccine. 3-year-old dog that's going in to have a general anesthetic procedure, I'd be recommending some baseline lab work, looking at maybe blood cell counts and maybe just a simple kidney test, liver test to make sure that there's nothing else going on there that's going to complicate anesthesia. And this is where I find that a lot of owners are like, they're young and healthy. I just want to cut corners. I don't want to have that done. But there's a reason why veterinarians recommend that. And it's because sometimes you can look at the pet from the outside. They look perfectly healthy and happy, and yet they may have something wrong, like low platelets count or, you know, something that could complicate surgery and cause bleeding. Or if, you know, they don't have, you know, white cell counts that are up to snuff, they could run into more problems with infections. If they've got, undiagnosed kidney disease, putting them under general anesthesia could push them over the brink. So we do it for a reason. It's to ensure that we are going to have, even though anesthetic complications are rare, we want to make sure that even those rare ones, we can probably try to cut down even more. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I rescued a German short-haired pointer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know much of his background. We've had him since last November, and the previous people that fostered him don't know when he had his shots last.
Mm-hmm.
They know he did, but
okay.
How soon will it hurt him to revaccinate?
Well, that's, again, a good question. I mean, if you are, by law, you have to be able to show proof of rabies vaccination.
And if
it hasn't been done, you can get it done again if you wish. Alternatively, I mean, you can get, if there's some reason why you don't want to be revaccinating your dog, there's a way of getting titers done, which is a blood test that looks at their immune status. But, I think in a case like this with an unknown entity, getting them vaccinated again, physical exam done, making sure they're healthy and happy, and getting them revaccinated would be in the dog's best interest.
Okay. Yeah, because he was way underweight, and I was worried it would hurt him if I revaccinated.
Yeah.
I didn't want him to get, I didn't know what would happen.
Remember, vaccines are for healthy pets. If he was underweight and having some, serious health problems, you don't want to be popping vaccines in at that point.
Okay. All right, he's up to weight now and doing great.
Great.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Deb. Ruth in Amro, your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Good afternoon, Larry and Sandy.
Good afternoon.
Great show as usual.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess this mainly Dr. Sandy Newberry was on last month?
Yes.
She brought up a discussion about a mites thing that they're seeing in a lot of kennels and that with cats.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes very hard to find.
Yes.
But it causes skin problems.
Uh-huh. It's called Demodex. Yeah, it's a Demodex mite that we're seeing more and more of in, like, large colony cats, where it's quite contagious, which is very different than Demodex mites in dogs, which is not contagious.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Can it be treated the same way as, like, the injectable for ear mites?
The way we typically treat ear mites is either with topical medications in the ears or a topical medication called Selamectin or Revolution that is applied on the skin between the shoulder blades and is absorbed through the skin. Using injectable medications, there are no licensed injectable medications for cats. You're using an off-label product, usually ivermectin, which is in, you know, a cattle or a horse product that is then being used in the cat. And although it's easy, it's not labeled for cat use, and there's a lot of very safe, very effective other things that you can use. Demodex mites are something that, you know, we typically do have to go with things that are more potent than what we use for ear mites. They're harder to get under control, and, you know, using your standard ear mite preparations typically don't get Demodex mites. So you're looking at needing to use something like higher levels of this drug that I just mentioned called ivermectin off-label to get it under control.
We had a previous cat years ago, and they tried to do the sonic flushing. And he ended up having an eye neural problem, so they had to treat with the injectable. And his eye did come back.
Okay.
The ear lid did come back.
So what happened was they were a little overzealous with cleaning the ears and ended up with causing some nerve damage to the nerve that runs up through the ear, a middle ear area, to supply the eye, and probably set up an inflammatory response. The fact that he got better, great. Sometimes that damage can be permanent, but I'm glad that he's back to being normal again. And you're right, if you've got that bad of an ear problem, putting stuff in the ear, if you've got a ruptured eardrum, can pose a health hazard for the pet. And so using systemic medications, and in this case, I like to use this product called Revolution or Selamectin rather than using off-label ivermectin, since that's labeled for cat use and for treating ear mites.
All right.
Okay. Now, I have my suspicions because we've done the antibiotic ointment on a skin irritation. We've tried some other things. We ran a culture for looking for fungus, but she's almost 10, and we never had her. She never had a skin problem until about off and on for the last year. We brought in somebody had left a little friend.
Oh, so you've had a new one brought in. Yeah.
Well, he'd been checked out and vaccinated, and he'd been treated in his ears and everything, but it isn't. He's over 2 now, but it just said, would like to find the person that dropped him off and do the same to them.
Oh, well, I think, you know, again, it sounds like your kitty's been in good hands, but yeah, finding these mites can be very difficult. Sometimes we have to pluck hairs and look at the hair bulbs under the microscope, skin scrapings. Sometimes we just end up having to treat if we're really suspicious of it as well. So
I would be suspicious.
Okay.
Thanks, Ruth, for calling. Scott in Madison, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Thanks. I'll be quick. I've got a pit bull black lab mix that completely freaks every time that there's anytime there's a storm. It could even be like just the drizzle that we had.
Oh, and this isn't quick. Okay.
So we've got the doggy or the Xanax or whatever it's called. And now I have, you know, I've used a drug that somebody gave me. I can't remember the name of it that really did seem to help.
Okay.
Any advice?
Okay. Few things. I'm just going to rattle them off and you can write them down, look them up. There's a cap for dogs called the calming cap that some dogs do very well with. It's not a muzzle. It goes over their eyes that they can see through a little bit. There's another device called the anxiety wrap that some people swear by that, again, these are things that are applied to the outside of the body, may make the dog feel more comfortable. Give him a bomb shelter. Give him a place that he can hide out in where he can be comfortable and relaxed. Medical management, I like Alprazolam. That's Xanax, as you said, as a good anti-anxiety drug. Some of these dogs do better with a little melatonin added in. You'll have to talk to your veterinarian about the dose for that, and it works for some dogs. There's some natural products that are available over the counter. I call it the beer, tea, and turkey treatment. It's usually chamomile, tryptophan, and hops in some proprietary combination. Some dogs do well with that. You know, teaching calming massage may help. Desensitizing to the storms may help with working with a behaviorist. There isn't one simple answer. There's all kinds of things that you can try. And, you know, I'd say, you know, all of them, you know, you may have to use all of them to be able to have some effect. Drugs alone may not work.
Thanks, Scott, for calling. And Sandy, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
We'll see you on April 15th.
15th. That's right. Tax day.
Tax day. All right. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be back on tax day, April 15th. I'll be away for a few days, but Jim Packard filling in for me. Tomorrow he talks with Matt Frank, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And then they'll take up the topic of biofuels with Tim Donahue from the University of Wisconsin. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.